It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
My name's Grace, and I live here in so-called Southern Oregon, in the Klamath-Siskiyou region, and on Takilma and Shasta land. And I'm a member of Siskiyou Rising Tide, which is one of many groups that opposed the Pacific Connector Pipeline and Jordan Cove Energy Export Project.
So just to get us started, can you tell us what the Jordan Cove Pipeline is?
The Jordan Cove Energy Export Project and Pacific Connector Pipeline is actually one of the longest running pipeline fights in North America. People were fighting it for about 15 years before it finally ground to a halt. It was a proposed fracked gas pipeline that would have been 230 miles long about. And it would have run from existing pipelines in eastern Oregon out to the Oregon coast, carrying fracked gas from the Rockies and from Canada out for export. And it's one of many attempts on the West Coast to have a fracked gas export project.
And I was looking through the write-up that was on your website about it, and one of the things that hit me was how much this intersected through different rivers, streams, and watersheds, which is what y'all pointed out. Let's just kind of talk about that for a second. Why is that so important, and what are the risks when a pipeline intersects with water, especially water that, you know, connects to ecosystems and the water that people are using maybe for fishing or drinking?
Yeah, so that's huge. It would have crossed 5 major watersheds. The Klamath, the Rogue, Coquille, Umpqua, and Coos. And, a major impact is just the actual construction. So, I'm sure if folks have been following pipeline fights, the, drilling that happens under the rivers, there's often these things that happen called frack outs, that cause like immense amount of water pollution just during construction. And then a lot of the other crossings, it would have been like hundreds of, stream and waterway crossings. A lot of the crossings would be trenching, which is also very invasive in those watersheds. And then it would have had a huge impact on the estuary, the Coos Bay estuary, which is just this incredibly important place for animals and people. There's fisheries there that depend on that estuary, and also oyster beds. It's a big oyster production area. And so all of those rivers, like the salmon in all those rivers, and all the people and animals who survive on those watersheds could have been impacted. And then obviously also like pipelines leak and have explosions and have other things happen after they're built. The logging that would happen to build the pipeline would have impacts as well.
So let's talk about the opposition that formed against this pipeline. And as you said, this people have been organizing against it for a long time, and right now it's dead. But let's kind of go back to the start. Talk about the role of both tribal governments in opposing the project and also indigenous people broadly fighting against the pipeline.
Yeah, so that's huge, and I hope I do it justice. So there's obviously all those rivers are impacted. There's those are the ancestral lands of many people. There was involvement in like formal opposition from tribal governments, from the Klamath tribes, the Yurok, the Sluts, the Tolwa Dene. All of those tribes formally opposed it. And then also there were tribes that participated in different ways. Significantly, when FERC approved the pipeline in 2020, there was this major lawsuit that was filed, and the Confederated Tribes of the Coos, Lower Umpqua, and Siuslaw, and the Great Band of Umpqua Indians both signed on to that lawsuit. And that's really important because there were like different ways that tribes and tribal communities participated in opposition besides just formally opposing the project. So like such as helping out with litigation, and then obviously all of the individuals and community groups and youth groups that helped fight the pipeline.
It's also mentioned that rural landowners played a part in opposing the pipeline. Talk about their role and what was at stake for them.
That was huge. Like the landowners, there were landowners that in the entire 15 years that people were, or over 15 years that people were fighting the pipeline, they resisted signing contracts with the pipeline company. And it looked different in different sort of like phases of the project. Oh, I should note that early on, it was actually an import project, which is kind of like a great, like to me, it's like just shows you what a scam capitalism is, because people were like living in these like rural areas opposing this pipeline that they were being told like needed to be built to import fracked gas. And then like a few years later, having to oppose it as an export project, just because like the market changed. So yeah, there was always landowners opposing it. And then in the last few years, there was like this really incredible coalition building that happened all along the pipeline route. So there was this like this really solid core of people that were prepared to resist eminent domain. Fortunately, people didn't end up having to do that. Like, I mean, they did in the sense of like organizing and voicing resistance, but, eminent domain proceedings didn't end up happening after FERC approved the pipeline.
I just think it's interesting. I remember interviewing folks that were resisting various pipelines in the Southeast, how much these pipeline fights just bring so many different groups of people together. And especially in areas that broadly are seen as conservative, it's just interesting the alliances that form against these projects.
I feel really inspired by being a part of this campaign, in part because it was so obvious that the pipeline company underestimated like what our communities, what our rural communities were capable of in opposing the project. I think that early on, I got involved like five to 7 years ago. I can't really remember now, but when I got involved, like there was this really strong narrative going on the state level that like Coos Bay, the place where the terminal would have been, was like for the pipeline. And it was just said all the time in meetings with politicians that like these rural communities just wanted it. And we had to like balance the needs of the environmentalists with these rural communities. And living in those communities, that's not what I saw at all. Certainly there's like some very like heavy strains of hyper-conservatism in those communities, but also there's always been people who were resisting this and who understood what was at stake and were really putting a lot on the line to fight the project. And so a lot of it was just like actually trying to like get all those people together and change that story so that that was being heard. And then I also think like, I just imagine that people who are just working in an office all the time and making a bunch of money and proposing projects like this, they must not understand that like, you know, like Indigenous folks living at the mouth of the Klamath, which was such a long drive from the upper Klamath, which is where the pipeline would have crossed, saw themselves as impacted by this project. And people who are living in these rural communities understand, like understand what a river is and understand how it works, and like that we are interconnected. And people were willing to like, you know, just drive hours and hours and hours to go to every possible comment, opportunity to give comment on the project, or opportunity to protest, or opportunity to like connect with other community members who were impacted, because they really felt that it impacted them, even if it was like way upstream.
So let's talk about how resistance to the project started to develop and people began to come together. What did that look like? And kind of take us back to the beginning of when people started to resist this thing.
It's like difficult to explain the breadth of this because it went on for so long. But basically, there was originally another company called Verizon that had proposed the pipeline. And then around the time that Standing Rock was happening, FERC actually denied the project for Verizon. And at that point, they denied the project, but then Trump came into power, and then this other company that was like had a lot more money behind them, called Pembina, took over, and then just went like really hard. And things got like a lot more intense, and it felt like in that second round, it felt a lot more likely that they were going to succeed. And so Pembina was like waging this like pretty massive PR campaign in rural communities. It was like anywhere you went, if you saw a television, there would be like an ad on for the pipeline company. And so it was sort of, there was like simultaneously like a messaging war going on at the same time that people were like fighting these permits and organizing in different ways. People succeeded in getting all those state permits denied. There was like three major state permit denials that happened in the last few years. But under Trump, they were basically trying to like change all the clean water rules so that it wouldn't matter that the state had opposed the project. And so it became really important that basically like the state at every possible angle was opposing the project. And so people, like, even though these permit denials had happened, like the governor of Oregon had not come out against the project. So people just started showing up at every state land board meeting where she was at and raising a stink and trying to get her to come out against it. And then that culminated in 2019. We had this like massive rally that turned into a sit-in in the governor's office. And basically, like, she wasn't there that day. Like, she was out having a meeting somewhere else. But everybody just like stayed in the Capitol and refused to leave and was singing and being rowdy and just sort of like getting to know each other if they weren't from the same places. And then eventually, she came and tried to talk to people and got an earful. And, there was arrests that happened that day. One of the demands of that action and one of the demands that had been happening over the year before was that she formally opposed the project and that if FERC approved the pipeline, which they were set to do, that she would commit to file a lawsuit and set in against the federal government from the state of Oregon. And in like right as the pandemic was coming down in the spring of 2020, FERC approved the pipeline. And for a lot of projects, for a lot of pipeline projects, that means construction starts. And so it felt really scary. But because of all this organizing that had happened, just giving FERC and Kate Brown tons of shit. FERC made an amendment that no tree clearing would be allowed on any part of the pipeline route, like no shovel could be put in the ground until some of these state issues were resolved. And then there was a big lawsuit that was filed where the state and tribes and conservation groups were all plaintiffs. So basically people won those demands. And then from there, things unraveled to the point that even though they had gotten the FERC approval, Pembina pulled out. So just through this like massive organizing, we managed to stop the pipeline, even though this federal approval happened.
You mentioned there was different phases. What did those phases look like? Walk us through the resistance.
I think that times in the pipeline fight before, you know, like Rogue Climate is one organization that we work with a lot, and Siskiyou Rising Tide, we've been around for a similar amount of time, like less than a decade. And before those organizations were around, I think a lot of it was like, lawyers and conservation groups really focusing on, the sort of like behind the scenes, like permit related things. And then also there was always landowner opposition. And I think the last, those last like 5 to 10 years is when we really saw people focus on organizing and like on like, just like understanding the role of like people who know what's at stake being the ones speaking about it and like having these really like powerful relationships and coalitions form between people. And that was like necessary to like thwart the right wing narrative and the police narratives and the politician narratives that were trying to say that our rural communities wanted this project.
We're going to switch gears now, and we're going to talk about basically how the Pipeline Corporation, which is a Canadian company, correct me if I'm wrong.
Yes, yeah, that's right.
Basically paid law enforcement to surveil anti-pipeline protesters. And this is something we saw and we've talked about on this show. It's a very similar situation to Line 3, where, again, I believe Enbridge, which is a Canadian company, was paying U.S. law enforcement to surveil and watch pipeline protesters, and the police were even like submitting basically invoices to them. And in return, they were also getting like equipment and different stuff. And of course, this is a different situation, but there's a lot of parallels, and they're very frightening, and we're going to go over them. But just kind of like give us a crash course. Who are the players and what was happening? How was this corporation interacting with law enforcement in the broad strokes here?
Basically, there was Pembina was collaborating with primarily with the Coos County Sheriff's Department, which is the Sheriff's Department where the terminal would have been built. They actually basically like bought out the Sheriff's Department. Like they were funding an entire arm of that Sheriff's Department years before there was any chance that the pipeline would be built even. And I think in my speculation that served two purposes. One was for the police to have more capacity to be monitoring pipeline activists, and just like local people who are holding events. And also just to like buy them out. And I think just like the context, like all these rural counties in Southern Oregon, like to pay for an entire wing of a sheriff's department is like huge. Like some of our rural sheriff's departments have had moments where they had like no funding because of, just like budget cuts at the county level. So, which as an aside is like fine with me, but you know, it's like, if you think about that, it's like a way of buying out a community. So they were doing that, and they were also buying all these war toys for the sheriff's department that would make it easier once people were, if people were putting their bodies on the line to oppose pipeline construction, it would make it easier for them to repress that resistance. And so that was happening locally. And then the Coos County Sheriff's Department was, collaborating with this big network, this big task force of law enforcement agencies at multiple levels, including the FBI, to monitor the campaign. And when we found out about it, it obviously felt really scary. I think it also wasn't that surprising, because, I mean, we just know whose side they're on, I guess. And the other thing about it was that because we always had direct action folks and radical folks like in the mix with the coalition, like we had had lots of conversations before this happened about, what we would call security culture and like digital security and like how to like decide what things you tell the public and what things to keep secret and how to like protect each other and not talk to the police. So when it happened, like I would actually just call it monitoring and not surveillance. just like for our own sake to understand that like they didn't get any secrets out of us. Like they were spending all these resources monitoring us, but everything that we've seen so far is them just like sharing emails with each other about like public events that we were having and, you know, like things that we weren't trying to keep secrets about is what they were finding out about. So it was more just like realizing, the depth of collaboration that was happening to oppose the people who were opposing this pipeline. Oh, and I should say too, I think an aspect of it that was especially disturbing is the fact that there was like consultants that worked with Tiger Swan and, police departments who were repressing people at Standing Rock, that those same consultants were being used to give presentations to our local police departments in Oregon.
Wow. Yeah, we're going to kind of get into the nitty gritty here right now. So there's a great article in The Intercept. We'll, of course, link that article in the show notes. But they ran an investigation that shed light into the fusion of these public and private interests working together to stifle opposition to the pipeline. So what else did the pipeline company and their goons do besides surveillance? How did it kind of like morph outside of just them watching people into other stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I think a big thing was like, we know that they were like providing training to the like consultants who had been involved in Standing Rock. Those same folks were also giving trainings to our local police departments on, and a lot of it was like related to PR actually, which is sort of interesting to me. Like a lot of it was like how you create messaging that justifies like repressing your own community basically. And so that was a focus of it. And then, I mean, honestly, they weren't being very effective, which is, and I'm not saying that to minimize the meaning of this because I actually think it's huge. And when it came out, we did, a lot of interviews and participated in like trying to get the message out about what was happening. But a lot of, like I was saying, like a lot of the stuff that they were actually sharing information with each other about was stuff that people were really intentionally being public about, just like a rally, for example. So in that sense, we could find out because there's still more, we still don't know everything about what was happening, but so far it seems like most of the, what's been called surveillance was them monitoring, like Facebook groups and events that were being put out intentionally publicly.
So as you said, the report states the former Tiger Swan consultants, and they're, of course, famous for their role in Standing Rock. A lot of them are ex-military, is my understanding, and they kind of provided this quasi-paramilitary, but they're like a corporation, sort of like Blackwater in Iraq. They serve the same purpose, it seems like. So they were enlisted to train Oregon law enforcement, and they had attempted to organize pro-pipeline counter-protests, according to leaked audio recordings. Again, this is according to the article in The Intercept, which is just bad. And they were encouraging dangerous tactics at one point in dangling the prospect of anonymous donations from oil companies. So let's talk about that. So they were actually not only giving presentations in front of law enforcement, they were trying to organize pro-pipeline protests like against the other protests. How did that go over?
So this is where I'm getting at. It's like a lot of the stuff was not surprising because it was already happening in some form. So like there was already this AstroTurf group called Boost Southwest Oregon that we knew was being funded by the pipeline company. Like it was above ground that it was being funded by the pipeline company. And they would bus people from cities to come show up in rural communities in support of the pipeline. And they would all wear these matching t-shirts. And they did have some local people involved, but for the most part, they were coming from out of town and being paid for by Pembina. And it just wasn't a secret. And like the only thing for us to do was out organize them, you know, like we just had to have more people than they did, which was possible because we just did. And we didn't have to pay people to get them to show up. Like our folks show up because they know what's at stake and they want to stop this pipeline. So it wasn't surprising to find out that they were looking for other ways to like create this sort of like false, the sort of like facade of a pro-pipeline movement. And I wish I had sort of like more complex things to say about it than to just say that like we have to expose them and out-organize them. And I know we can do it, you know, like, because I feel like in this case we did. Like it ended up kind of just being like egg on their face. Especially when this story broke and it became like so much more apparent, like the level of like the amount of resources that they were putting into, squashing dissent. I want to say too, early on when, Siskiyou Rising Tide became a group, before we ever knew, and I don't know if there was any level of like funding or coordination happening back during that time period, but it was like way before this story had broken. We had experiences of the Coos County Sheriff's Department, showing up at events and trainings. There was one time where we were like getting ready to hold a rally in North Bend, which is the small town right next to the, Port of Coos Bay. And, you know, I was like a part of organizing it and they had been following us around to our events and trainings and had gotten our address from someone's license plate number, you know, so they'd like run a license plate and then showed up like pounding on my door at like the crack of dawn one morning to like ask questions about. It was a rally and I don't want to like do the like good protester, bad protester thing, you know, like I think it's important to say like, regardless of what was being organized, like that's not okay. But it was especially sort of like humorous to like think about, just the level of like creepiness that they were having at that stage in the campaign.
Well, what was the impact of all of this on the resistance, all the surveillance? Did that hinder stuff? Was it just kind of a distraction?
We worked really hard. I mean, I don't want to speak on behalf of like everybody who feels impacted by it because I know that for some people it was really frightening and I'm sure it caused some people to want to stay home a little bit more than they would have. But from my perspective, and we did put a lot of effort into like supporting people around this, I felt like it was galvanizing because it really, you know, like I'm part of a group that's like explicitly abolitionist and anti-capitalist. We're in a coalition where not everybody shares those viewpoints. And we're working together and sometimes you don't agree on everything and that's fine. It is what it is. And then when you see that, like, regardless of where you're stationed in that campaign, that, your local police are collaborating with this pipeline company to, squash your voice, I think it really does help, like, help people understand why it's important to, resist state repression and, know your rights and like understand security culture and things like that, that those are issues that often get, sort of marginalized to being like radical community issues, but actually, our whole community can benefit from knowing about those things. So in that way, I think it really backfired on them. And I think, you know, we do have relatively, you know, I hesitate to say this, but we do have like relatively progressive people in power at the state level. And so I don't think that those folks, like, regardless of their motivations, I don't think they want to be on the side of like a creepy, like, machine for state violence against, rural communities who are opposing a pipeline. So it just like creates an optic that I think actually worked out in our favor in this case. Mm-hmm.
despite all this, people still won. So explain how kind of the end for the pipeline came. Like, how did victory come about?
I know when I talk about this, it kind of gets into like alphabet soup. So I apologize for that. But, I mean, basically these permits were denied. And then after that, even though the pipeline company was basically like appealing to the Trump administration to try to get the project pushed through, even though local and state people didn't want it to be here. And that failed. And one of the things we saw in the last 2 years before the pipeline company actually withdrew from the project is that they stopped spending money. So they had been waging this like really intense PR campaign locally, and they have like offices open in rural communities and running all these ads on TV and stuff. And they just stopped spending money on that and they closed their offices. And that was like before they got their FERC approval and before the project was like finally ended. In the last few months, basically they tried to make kind of like a final appeal and it just didn't work out, and they withdrew. They basically like withdrew from the project. So they like officially, the company officially canceled the project. Cause they were basically like stuck. There was no more avenues that they could go to get it approved. So they withdrew from it.
You all were saying before we started recording that there was a lot learned in terms of organizing as anarchists and being the quote radical flank in coalitions. Explain that. Like, what did you learn? And what do you mean by that, being the radical flank in a larger coalition of groups?
For us, I mean, before the campaign started, some of us had been involved in some way in other pipeline campaigns, even just like peripherally, and just understood that people can be like brilliant and fierce and incredible and still lose. You know, like, it's like pipeline fights are really hard, and people, once the pipeline is being built, it is incredibly hard to stop it from, being built all the way. And that's not like, you can have amazing strategy and fierce tactics and like an incredible number of people on your side. And that's still oftentimes the situation. So I think for us, like when we formed as a group, we wanted to be in our communities because we lived in Southern Oregon, and we wanted to like be true to like our politics and how we felt about the world and about pipelines and capitalism and colonization. And also be there for the whole campaign. Like, you know, it seemed early on like we might be having to have a ground fight pretty quickly. And then it turned out that there was just a lot of time before that was going to be the, like, inevitability. And so we just sort of leaned in to, like, being a part of the whole campaign and being in coalition and trying to find ways to build a culture of direct action and radicalism, like, even though we weren't, like, fighting bulldozers. And that was like a mutual, like, it took people within the wider coalition who were focused on different tactics than us also wanting that to be the case and like understanding the value in that. And also us like oftentimes having like difficult conversations with people or like standing our ground about things that we thought were important. Yeah. And I think another thing that feels important to me for people to know or to think about is I just think there's like a lot of weird stereotyping of rural communities in conversations about tactics. And my experience of like being a part of like climate justice and forest defense in rural communities is that like, it's definitely the case that not everybody you're working with is like down to do direct action or whatever, but I don't really see those lines being drawn along like, rural and urban, you know, and I think that's like a story that gets told a lot that just needs to be squashed, and that actually like, we can have that sort of like ecosystem of tactics and strategies exist in rural communities and be led by those communities. And, yeah. And so just like trying to do this radical shit, like in the context we're in these places where we're also dealing with like really intense, right-wing ideology around us, but there's like really amazing people in these communities to, build with and fight with, fight alongside.
You know, one of the things I was thinking about, I was looking at that Intercept article, was just, you know, the electronic counterinsurgency and astroturfed opposition. And, you know, why aren't we better at recognizing this and dealing with it? Like, just as we're recording this today, Unicorn Riot just put out another massive leak of Patriot Front internal documents and ongoing that literally like them, like, I hope no one ever sees us committing these crimes we're doing. You know, why aren't we able to do that with this type of stuff? Like, we have the tools. Like, why aren't we mapping out sort of these astroturf corporate backed groups and, you know, online counterinsurgency campaigns?
Yeah, I mean, I can't really speak to like the bigger picture of our movements, but I think it's pretty fun to dig stuff up about like a rural sheriff's department, for example, because they don't like, and I, you know, I'm not claiming to have done that work, but like to be a part of a campaign where things like that were exposed. It's actually like that strategy of like digging up information and exposing it, I think is more accessible than people realize. It has to do with like getting to know your local, like, process for requesting public records. And also just like valuing that as a strategy within, your organization or your movement or campaign or whatever sort of formation you're in. And it's a great role to, like, a lot of people don't love meetings, but they could still like help gather information or like understand what's happening at levels of power. And I think too, like, the enemy's like pretty messy a lot of times. Like they think that they're doing things covertly that are actually, they're just like using, you know, they're just like using their like work email to like monitor a bunch of people in a way that's like, would be pretty embarrassing if people found out about it, you know? So it's just like stuff like that, that I think it would be cool to see more people doing that. And I do think there are a lot of people doing it. So just to like sort of encourage that as like, as strategy to uncover what is happening.
You know, one thing I wanted to ask you is that you're involved in Rising Tide, which is a group, or I guess it better described as a network.
Yeah.
Where is that now? And I'm just curious, you know, like within that constellation, what are people saying in terms of this organizing against infrastructure projects with just where we're at right now with climate change? Has the conversation changed, you know, from 10 years ago, I would say, you know, the sort of like post Inconvenient Truth era to, or, you know, post Anti-Globe to now in today's world?
Yeah, that's such a big topic. And I know like my buddies and other Rising Tide chapters would probably all have like slightly different things to say about it. So, I mean, just talking about it here, gosh. Yeah, I mean, it feels really different. I always end up speaking from a very local vantage point because I am just kind of obsessed with where I live. But it's tough now because we're just in it, right? Like the two towns that, like the town, the office of Rogue Climate, who was like central to fighting this pipeline, burnt down in the Alameda fire, in 2020. So if you just think about that, like we're like fighting this massive infrastructure with the idea that we're fighting climate change. Well, it's just like here now. And I don't really think that like our organization specifically, like Siskiyou Rising Tide, like has a clear vision of how we're addressing that, except that like we've just completely thrown ourselves into mutual aid organizing. I mean, like right now, most of our focus is on homelessness actually, and like being there for our friends on the streets and all the ways that they're being impacted by the climate crisis. So yeah, that's really just like the question right now. Like, I don't think I have the answer. But it's feeling like, the ground is shifting underneath us, and we probably need to be having that conversation a lot more.
You're listening to It's Going Down, part of the Channel Zero Anarchist Podcast Network. Follow us online at itsgoingdown.org and on Twitter at @IGD_news. If you like and appreciate this podcast, go to itsgoingdown.org/shop and give us a one-time donation. Sign up to donate monthly or donate through Bitcoin. Again, that's itsgoingdown.org/shop to support. And now, back to the show. Year after year, we're just inundated with report on top of report about how bad things are getting. The Biden administration, I think while a lot of us had no illusions going into it, there was some hope that there was going to be some sort of addressing of these concerns, because it seems even within the elites, there's at least an acknowledgement that yes, climate change is real and it's probably pretty bad. But interestingly enough, it seems like they've only doubled down, like pushing for more oil production, more pipelines. What's your take on all that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that on a personal level, and I didn't really think about what my messaging points were around this, I don't have a lot of hope around climate, like what we were calling climate justice before. And what I'm looking for instead is like sort of things that are focused on indigenous sovereignty and, people who are like trying to bring back cultural fire to like restore and prevent catastrophic fires that are just like burning down their towns. That's like a big indigenous rights issue where we are. And then also just like the ways that like the narrative, like in positions of power, seems to be moving from like before they ever even admitted that climate change was happening, they were already shifting from figuring out how to like exploit the situation and like take more land from people and take more power. And now we're hearing like all these proposals about lithium mining, which is a huge threat to land and water and indigenous sovereignty that is being touted as like a solution because you need lithium for like Teslas and stuff, you know? And so I think it's more important now than ever to not just be focused on the issue, but to be focused on the values underneath that issue. And like incorporate anti-state and anti-fascist, and anti-capitalist, organizing and connections and relationships into whatever campaign or front we're working on. I don't want to say I don't have hope in climate justice, because I think it means a lot of different things to different people. And I am very close and love people who are fighting really hard on that front, and like they still see that as their front. I just think at this point, we're well past preventing that, you know? We're just in it. Like, I just feel like I can depend on like a town near me burning down next summer, and like the people I'm in community with are going to be there for each other and trying to help each other survive that. And so at this point, the fight feels fundamentally different than when I first got involved, which like I'm pretty young. So just to be real, it wasn't that long ago. And I think we have to think about how these fronts change from generation to generation, but that there's some overarching things that, you know, decolonization being one of them, that continue to be really central to what we care about and what we're fighting for.
Well, also I wanted to ask you, and we've asked everybody that's involved in eco defense and organizing around the climate this, but this has kind of changed since the pandemic, but over the last couple of years we've seen kind of the rise of Greta and these like so-called climate strikes, these kind of mass, almost like a return to like the anti-war movement, just, you know, hundreds of thousands of people out in the street around climate change. And at the same time, there doesn't seem to be any kind of disruptive or radical edge to that, like within like the demonstrations themselves. And I'm just curious, do you have any hope that like that will manifest into something that's like, you know, anti-colonial, anti-capitalist, that gets at the heart of, you know, the civilization and starts to push back against it? Or are you pessimistic about something coming out from that, those kind of currents?
Yeah, well, I never want to, you know, like whatever gets people in the streets or gets people a part of a movement, everyone's got their entry point. Or like, I just want to be really clear. Like I come from like a very specific vantage point of where I'm living. And so I don't feel like an expert in that. I think I was really inspired, you know, right before the pandemic, who's like people, indigenous folks like fighting Coastal GasLink were like shutting down rail lines all across so-called Canada. And I just was like, I don't like, if you look at a certain, if you look through like a certain pinhole at the climate movement, it doesn't look very good. But if you look at what indigenous folks are doing and, what other communities of color are doing on their front lines, like there's just the last few years, there's just so many amazing examples of what's possible. And so I try to not like, yeah, I think that hope is always like where like the people are rising up and fighting, you know?
Well, just to kind of sign us off, what happens now? This pipeline is dead. What is next for everybody that was involved? On to the next thing?
Yeah, well, it's been cool. I mean, it hasn't been cool in the sense that a bunch of people lost their homes. That's been horrific. It's been cool to see how much the connections that people built through fighting a pipeline have been supportive of people, like, doing really rad mutual aid work. So that's what's happening here right now. I don't think we've really, like, stuck our head out for, you know, like, we're just sort of, like, in here doing that, and we haven't been involved in, like, a specific campaign, like, infrastructure-related campaign since the pipeline went down. So that's just sort of where we're at right now. Siskiyou Rising Tide is really involved in a project called Judy's Midnight Diner, which is a street outreach. Basically, we go out a couple times a week and on the coldest nights of the month during the winter. And we have hot meals and harm reduction. And we set up these pop-up tents with heaters in them so that people can get out of the cold for part of the night. And that's what we've been focused on. And it's been cool to do rowdy stuff related to housing and like think about that front line right now, because it's pretty huge. It's pretty huge in our community. So that's mostly what we're focused on at the moment.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us, and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.